This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, Sue Balcom talks about the winged wonder that is the hummingbird. But we're going to start with a different kind of winged wonder, an airplane. And there is an upcoming air show in Williston. And we are speaking now with the director of the Williston Basin International Airport, Anthony Dudas. Anthony, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me today.
So in the past few years, there have been lots of exciting developments for the Williston Airport. There has been a complete change of location. There's been addition of flights, temporary suspension of flights, and now you have this inaugural air show. It's coming up on September 11th. Gates open at 7 a.m. The show begins at 10 a.m. What made you want to host an air show?
Well, it's something we've always wanted to do as the city of Williston. And with this new facility, the new Williston Basin International Airport, it has allowed us a lot of more opportunity for these types of events. The way that it's designed and constructed allows for that flexibility for us to close surfaces and allow for the public to come out and enjoy this beautiful new facility we have. So now with the pandemic having gone on and obviously still working through those challenges, but with events now occurring, we're able to finally host our first real event at XWA. We unfortunately weren't able to celebrate the first year of operation last year due to the pandemic, and this air show coming this Saturday is really that first kickoff event, and we're hoping to have a really great family-friendly event here this weekend and continue to build this bigger and better every year.
What can people expect?
So we are going to have, as you mentioned already, the gates are opening at 7 a.m., and there's going to be a free pancake breakfast hosted by the local Lions clubs here in Williston. And we're hoping that we get a lot of attendance from regional pilots. It is a fly-in breakfast, so we're hoping some aircraft come in from around our region and come enjoy the facility and allow our community to come out and see aircraft operating at XWA and have the opportunity to get aircraft rides through Overland Aviation. They're charging $25 per person. Strongly recommend that everybody come. If you're interested in getting up in an aircraft that day, you come and reserve your spot early because they do fill up. They tend to be very popular. So with that, we're going to have that free pancake breakfast starting at 7 a.m. We are having a ribbon cutting for our new Customs and Border Protection facility that allows us to have that international designation, and it allows private traffic to go anywhere in the world to and from XWA. We are a port of entry to the United States here. As an example, we have an aircraft scheduled to come in this weekend from London on their way to California. So they're able to stop in at XWA, clear customs to get into the United States, and continue on to their final destination. So we're going to have that ribbon cutting. Overland Aviation is also going to do their ribbon cutting that day as well. And Overland Aviation is the entity that provides fuel services, flight instruction, aircraft rental, maintenance, all of those services that keep aircraft in the air and flying around.
What's the process of getting that customs designation?
Our former facility, Sloan Field International Airport, also was a port of entry, and so that has been in existence for a significant period of time. I honestly don't know the start date of that port of entry in Williston, but keeping that designation at XWA involved a lot of coordination with our city leadership, our state leadership, and the federal government to ensure that it was a need for our region, and had a lot of support from our congressional delegation to make sure that that stayed here in Williston.
What kinds of doors does that open up, besides the fact that you can attract maybe bigger routes?
Well, we are a global economy here in western North Dakota and eastern Montana with the oil and ag industries, and it's really important that we have that ability to allow for that flexibility of travel to and from our region. And it also is just another economic driving tool in our toolbox here in Williston to ensure that entities, companies, individuals, and things of that nature have that opportunity that they may need for their travel.
It's an exciting weekend for all things up in the sky over in Medora. There's the Badlands Hot Air Balloon and Kite Festival, and then now you are having the air show in Williston. And I'm wondering the date. I know you said there was a COVID postponement. You had hoped to have a big celebration a year ago, but it's falling on September 11th. This year is the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks. Was that date chosen for that reason?
No, the date was definitely not chosen for that specific reason. We were working towards finding dates that worked for our community and allowed for hopefully good weather and things of that nature. But it wasn't lost on us that we did decide to choose to host this event on Saturday, September 11th, and the 20-year anniversary of those attacks on our country. And we will absolutely be honoring all of those that were impacted, affected, lost their lives, and all of those that have served our country since that time frame and before as part of this event. So we have a really great program for our community. We're going to have Miss North Dakota on site with the Color Guard singing the national anthem. We also are going to be honoring a military veteran, a 98-year-old gentleman who was actually in the Blue Angels before they were part of the Blue Angels, the Navy Naval Aerobatic Squadron. And so we think that we still want to have that opportunity to enjoy that day and celebrate our facility, but also honor those and the history of that day.
Yeah, it sounds like a fine line to walk when you are talking about airplanes, and they have this long history in winning wars, and the pilots who flew these incredibly dangerous missions in World War II and in Vietnam, and then also happening on the same day of an attack that involved airplanes.
I would agree, and I think that we are treading that line, and I think that the community will have that opportunity to come out, have a great event for our community and for our region, but also honor those that were impacted by the September 11th attack.
Are there any weather concerns? It is maybe a slight chance of rain in the forecast for the Williston area for Saturday.
Well, you know, the weather is always a challenging item to work through. It's something that is completely beyond everybody's control. And it appears that it's still going to be able to allow for a full air show to occur as of today's forecast. But I honestly don't trust those forecasts until about the day
20 minutes.
So we will see how that works out. But we of course are hoping for really great weather for the show and for the public to come and enjoy it. It looks like it might be a little cooler than it has been throughout the summer since it's been so incredibly warm in our region. So encourage people to bring comfortable clothing and chairs for them to sit in, but we don't have any anticipation of any effect of the air show today based on the weather forecast.
So there was a recent launching of the Sun Country flight to Las Vegas. This was about a week ago, right?
That is correct. Last Thursday, September 2nd.
How long does it take to get a new flight launched into an airport? I can't even imagine where to start.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing conversation for a significant period of time. Really, it stems back to the 2012, 2013, 2014, as the city leadership was really working towards identifying the issues with our former facility and really got the idea to build the new Williston Basin International Airport at XWA here. The facilities we had didn't allow for the city to expand air service. They didn't allow for these larger aircraft that Sun Country flies, as an example, to operate. It required significant reconstruction of that facility, and really it involved building a new airport either in a greenfield like we ultimately chose to do, or building a brand new airport on the Sloan Field property. Every single piece of that infrastructure would have had to be replaced. So there were conversations and letters of intent signed by airlines in 2014 stating that they would be operating in Williston if the facilities and infrastructure were to accommodate their aircraft size. And unfortunately, that at that point in time, the city couldn't and didn't have a final decision made based on all of the coordination with the federal and state entities that are involved in building a new airport. And, you know, you have to say no to those requests. And that's something that the city of Williston absolutely did not want to be in the position to do. So with that, we continue those conversations with those airlines. And now that we have a new facility that can accommodate those aircraft, we've been working with Sun Country Airlines for several years now to identify where and when the appropriate time is to launch that service. And we were able to partner with them recently, just this summer, to kick off this direct flight to Las Vegas out of XWA.
The Williston Basin International Airport has flights already to Denver, which is a United hub, and to Minneapolis, which is a Delta hub. It seems like, just anecdotally here, every time an airport launches a new flight, it's always to Las Vegas. Is it, you know, because of the allure, the appeal of the city itself, or is there a strategic reason for Las Vegas?
Yeah, you know, as we work with airlines, there is information that's gathered by the air carriers themselves on where people are flying, how they're getting there, and what their sensitivity is to fares. And as an example, if you had a credit card based out of Williston, our zip code, and you bought a ticket out of the Bismarck Airport, that information is captured, and they can see that you should have flown out of the Williston Airport if all things were the same. So why didn't you? And that's where we can drill into, okay, somebody flew from Bismarck to Las Vegas, as an example, on one of their low-cost carriers that's available out of their facility. And we can see that information, and we're able to make educated decisions on those routes that are proven to be needed or people are using but maybe not out of their local airport. So we work through those pieces of data that are collected and identify those specific markets that we want to initiate service to. And of course, some of that has to do with our community and our city leadership and identifying where they would like to see service as well.
Does it become then a statewide conversation? Bismarck would have a vested interest, for example, in Williston not getting that Las Vegas route.
Absolutely. You know, airports compete with each other. We operate similar to a private business in that respect, and our goal is to be self-sustaining based on our rates and charges and the markets that we serve. And we also want to make sure that we're providing the quality of life that our communities deserve. And adding service to one airport could potentially have an impact to another regional airport that has a similar type of service. But it's also something that airlines look at as well. Of course, the airline at the end of the day is the business that's going to be making money off of these flights, and they want to make sure that if they're initiating service at one facility, it's not going to impact their service at another facility, or that they're not cannibalizing that market in some way, shape, or form. So we work with them, of course, on those types of conversations, and at the end of the day, we as a community need to be able to justify why we think that service to a specific community is needed and will be utilized. So with that being said, you know, Las Vegas was the highest priority market for us, but we have other high priority markets that we're looking to enhance as well in the future.
Can you give us a teaser?
Well, absolutely. The City Commission actually approved an incentive program earlier this summer. And that includes markets like Phoenix and Fort Myers, Florida, and Houston, Texas, as those examples. Those are all high-priority markets that we would like to see air service to in the future. We, of course, need to show and work through all of those processes and communications and partnerships that we have developed with these air carriers that we currently have and potentially new ones in the future.
What kind of staffing issues have you noticed specific to the pandemic?
As everybody dealt with, everything shut down and a lot of staffing changes happened. Fortunately for us at the airport, specific to the city of Williston staff, we maintained our staffing levels because while there's less passenger traffic, our responsibilities stay the same. We still have to snowplow runways. We still have to provide firefighting. We still have to mow grass. We still have to maintain all of our facilities. But a lot of the other businesses, those private entities that rely on us, were not quite so fortunate, and they had to reduce staffing based on the market that they were in at that point in time. But since the pandemic has started to turn and passenger traffic has significantly improved, a lot of our tenants here have been looking for workforce, and it's a huge challenge for everybody involved. We, as a city of Williston, have several positions that are open and available, and I know that our tenants also have positions that are available as well. So there's a lot of opportunity for those jobs to be had, especially at our airport, and I know that's a common theme across the nation.
What first piqued your interest in aviation?
I started flying at my local airport. I'm originally from southern Minnesota when I was 16 years old, and got a job there putting fuel in airplanes and scrubbing the bugs off the windshields. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't historically necessarily in my family. It's just something that had always been an interest for me. And I was able to get that opportunity at that local facility, and it was just onward and upward from there.
Anthony Dudas is the airport director of the Williston Basin International Airport. It will host the inaugural XWA air show coming up this Saturday. Gates open at 7 a.m. and the show begins at 10 a.m. Anthony, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Main Street, historian Tom Ezern has a Plainsfolk essay.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Next time on The Pulse, Andrew Barnes thought his employees were going to be thrilled when he introduced a four-day work week with the same salary and benefits. But instead of applause,
it was shock, followed by nervous laughter, because what was the catch, right?
Could a shorter work week lead to healthier and happier employees?
That's The Pulse, coming up at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Tom Ezern has a few loves: history, his wife Dr. Kelly, and singing. And they all come together in today's Plainsfolk essay, Hundreds of Ballads.
Now and then, in the middle of a Plainsfolk essay, you may hear me erupt into song, sometimes mournful, sometimes exuberant, because singing is a significant part of my life. I am, as I sometimes remark, an unreconstructed folky from the 1970s. And there was a time when I made rent with a Martin Dreadnought. Thank God I don't have to do that now, because the music business is full of, real musicians. Indeed, for years the Martin and I went quiet, singing to ourselves into a canine chorus and only occasionally in public. Then came the COVID thing, and out of that isolation, my bully pulpit here at Prairie Public notwithstanding, I confessed to Dr. Kelly my desire to let loose another yop of Whitman-esque proportions. She enabled the scheme, in fact moved into a production role, as the Willow Creek Folk School went live weekly at 8 p.m. Fridays on the Facebook page of Plains Folk. Right now, we're preparing to live stream Willow Creek Folk School number 70. The thing took an unexpected direction because since the 1970s, I've become more and more a self-conscious, assiduous, perhaps obsessive research historian on the prowl 24/7 for research opportunities. Launching into the old standards of Great Plains folk song, The Cowboy's Lament and Little Old Sod Shanty and all the rest of them, I began to wonder if it were now possible to resume historical research in regional folk song on a whole new plane, higher and deeper. You see, past students of folk song were hobbled by some quaint assumptions about balladry that originated in Britain and then migrated to America, taking up residence in places with ivy on their walls. The scholars in Tweed propounded the idea that ballads were the stuff of rustic, illiterate, tribal peoples who left few tracks and fewer records. Thus, the songs were assumed to be beyond the reach of research. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, a grand generation of song catchers, folk song collectors, spanned the Great Plains from John Lomax in Texas to Franz Rickaby in North Dakota, going over the ground, collecting folk song out of the air, making modest inquiries of their informants as to the lineage of the ballads, but not seriously tracing their origins. The prairie song catchers were constrained by the same assumptions as their peers and mentors in New England. Except, of course, for Louise Pound at the University of Nebraska, a remarkable woman in many ways, a world-class athlete in multiple sports, the first female president of the Modern Language Association, and, in matters of scholarly dispute, a fearless antagonist. A Nebraska girl, despite her academic attainments, she defended the singers of her home country against their portrayal as tuneful rubes. Folk songs, she insisted, were the works of creative artists, passed around among the people by whatever means they possessed, adapted and refined by other artists among them to give voice to the people's experience. Now, you can tell I really like Louise Pound, right? Because she was a research scholar who loved folk song and also loved her home country. What she did not have, but I do have, as I relaunch my career as a folklorist, is the capacity to contact trace the old folk songs through the mists of antiquity and identify their originators and evolutions. This I can do because of the digitization of primary sources, particularly newspapers, and optical character recognition, which makes the sources searchable through internet portals. So, who wrote Little Old Sod Shanty on the Claim? I still can't tell you, but I can hand you 50 or more versions culled from the song's life up and down the plains. And I can tell you precisely who wrote the stanzas to that great populist anthem, The Hayseed, and where it was first sung. All this new data is great, but new data requires new theory, and so I am working on that. In the meantime, I have the songs, hundreds of them, to sing.
Dr. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, Sue Balcom talks about hummingbirds. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Former Minnesota Senate Republican leader Paul Gazelka has announced he is running for governor. Gazelka says if elected, he would not rule out signing an abortion law like the one in Texas that prohibits the procedure after 6 weeks of pregnancy. Gazelka says he would consult with groups that oppose abortion on how far and fast to go.
Every bill I have to see, and so I don't make commitments that directly other than to say I'm pro-life. My whole record shows that I'm pro-life, and so it would follow down that path is where I would be.
Abortion restrictions have not been enacted in Minnesota in more than a decade, given Democratic control of the governor's office and at least one house of the Minnesota legislature. The director of North Dakota's Workforce Safety and Insurance Agency says the agency has put a lot of emphasis on safety, and Brian Klipfel says it's paying off.
And we do so much to try to make our workplace safer. And, you know, I think compared to any other insurance company or workers' comp agency, we just do so much. Our claim count, injuries per 100 people have gone down. Our injured employees or injured workers per 100, that number has gone down. So And the number of claims have gone down. So we really think that our programs are making a difference. And it's a combination of things, but safety is a big thing, too, for the companies.
Klipfel says that's why the agency's premiums are the lowest in the country, while benefits are in the top 25%. And nearly 3,300 citations were given out during the latest law enforcement click-it-or-ticket campaign. The campaign ran from July 1st to August 19th. Lauren Bjork is Safety Public Information Program Manager for the North Dakota Department of Transportation. She says law enforcement agencies worked overtime to issue 3,283 citations. Of those, 1,241 were for failing to wear a seatbelt, and another 34 were issued for improper child restraint. Bjork says North Dakota typically has higher rates of compliance for seatbelt use, but also says some people just don't want to wear them. But she also says the majority of roadway fatalities this year were of those who were unbuckled.
Right now, our fatalities are trending very high for 2021. We have 74 fatalities so far this year compared to 63 in 2020. So we really want people to be wearing that seatbelt. Nearly 56% of our fatal crashes, people were not wearing their seatbelts. So something that you can do every time you get behind the wheel.
Bjork also says 1,325 speeding tickets were given out, as well as 21 drug arrests, 22 citations for distracted driving, and 289 overall traffic stops. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Hi, Peter Sagal here, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Prairie Public is celebrating 40 years of radio, and they have invited me to zoom in on the party to play Not Dave's Job with news director Dave Thompson. Did I say yes? Of course I did. Zooming. It's fun. Join us Saturday, September 25th at the Radisson in Bismarck. Get your tickets at prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-6900. Congratulations, Dave and Prairie Public, for 40 outstanding years serving the great people of North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And joining me now from our Bismarck studio is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, you sent some topics, and this first topic is hummingbird. And I'm going to guess you don't want to talk about eating hummingbirds.
No, they aren't even big enough for an appetizer.
Yeah, I know,
let's
right?
face the facts.
Let's not eat them. But if you're talking eat a lot of sugar and bounce around from one beautiful thing to the next,
that'd be
I'm
me.
I'm way ahead of you.
I love it. I never even put two and two together.
Yeah, I totally. My husband is like, are you a hummingbird?
That's awesome. Because they are extraordinary. And we are fortunate enough to have one or two or three or four hummingbirds, never more than that, every year. And so we do feed them. However, the topic of hummingbirds came up at our house because my husband gave himself the David Attenborough Award. Now, your viewers probably...
Did he present himself with a statue? Or...
Yeah, he was so proud of himself. David Attenborough, just for those people who don't
know, Attenborough. Isn't it?
There we go. That's what it is. But he was down at the other end of the tunnel. But we watched this PBS program all the time where, you know, he's an environmentalist and he's watched the degradation of forests and oceans and things for so many years. You've just got to believe this guy, right? So he is an environmentalist. JC likes this kind of stuff. And so one of the things about the birds that we have, the hummingbirds and otherwise, is that I grow flowers inside my high tunnel, sunflowers and other flowers. And, you know, hummingbirds love color and nectar. And so there's this little tiny hummingbird, and he's trapped inside this big high tunnel, and he can't get out. And so I'm rolling down the sides, and I'm saying, please help me. I don't know what to do. And the poor little thing had to been getting tired, because we will talk about how busy they flap their little – they don't flap their wings. But so we're
Wait,
like –
what are they doing?
They do their wings are done in like a figure eight. Like they whip them around in a figure eight. And
oh,
they're
cool.
So tiny, and they're friendly too. So if you start feeding them, and then you start, like, you can actually get them to drink out of your hands if you're patient enough. They're just so sweet. So we got this bird, and one time one got caught in there and it died, and I was heartbroken about that. And then one time some other bird got in there, and the cat got in there at the same time. And if you put two and two together, that did not end well for that bird either.
No.
However, we have this tool that we use that looks like a really wide hole. And so JC was going to like kind of shoo him out. And it that didn't work, but he was holding it when he was standing at the other end of the tunnel. And this little thing lit on it, like just sat on the top of this tool. And JC walked him down the 90 feet to the door and
wow.
let him out.
Oh, I love JC.
I know. Oh. And that's why he gave himself the David Attenborough Burger Award or whoever that guy
is. Attenborough
Award. And I thought, oh, let's talk about hummingbirds because this is the time of year that the birds, some of them, disappear. And I asked my husband already, I said, have the geese headed south yet? Because I really want it to stay nice for a little while longer. And he said no. And so the hummingbirds are also a migratory bird. And I did not know that because we have found their little teeny tiny nests in our trees. And by teeny tiny, these yeah. things are only about 2 inches long. And weigh less than 2 grams. So, I mean, they're just,
what?
And they're so slippery. They almost look like a fish sometimes. Their bodies are so fluid when they're flying. And naturally, do you have hummingbirds that come around your place?
We have had a few, yeah, when the apricot tree is in blossom in particular, but sometimes throughout the summer.
And they're iridescent. Like,
oh,
they're
they
such
are magical.
Beautiful little birds.
They
and
are.
They beat those wings about 80 times per second in a figure eight pattern, which means that they can helicopter. You know, like when I'm standing by the door and the bird comes at the same time every morning to the feeder, it'll stop and it'll kind of hover there. And mm-hmm. I can hear the wings, so I know it's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And if I move at all, it'll flit away. But if I'm very still, it will actually stop and it will eat. And so they're just so much fun to watch and take photographs of.
Yeah, if you can get your focus.
That's right they before are. They fly away.
So are they pollinating your gardens?
Oh, absolutely. I'm positive. I've seen them go from flowers outside to flowers inside.
Mm.
The only thing that disturbs me this time of year with the little buggers is that the hornets are out.
Oh.
And they have just showed up within the past week or so at the farmer's market, too. And so anything sweet or, you know, sugary or red or whatever, mm-hmm. the hornets are there right with the hummingbirds in the flower garden and their feeder. Which I think makes them a natural enemy of the hummingbirds.
I think everything is a natural enemy of a hornet.
The hornets, yeah. Yes.
However,
my advice would be to quit flapping around when you see them because that's what people do. And that's when they get bit. I'm like, just leave them alone.
Last time. Yeah.
Yep. You panic. But anyway, hummingbirds, like, they are in the spring, they fly thousands of miles northward. And so when somebody says, oh, you eat like a bird, it doesn't necessarily mean that you don't eat. You eat teeny tiny meals. It means that you're eating constantly.
All day. Yeah.
Yes. Because flying that far is definitely a trip. And so they come up here. They come up as far north as Alaska. And so we're kind of thrilled that we actually got this. And they're not the real, real colorful varieties that live up here. But we have seen ruby-throated hummingbirds up here once in a while. And I don't know if this is the same bird that keeps coming back or if it's different, but they make round-trip migration flights of more than 1,600 kilometers, which is like almost 1,000 miles. And they have lots of energy, of course. And so when the wind blows, like, well, they're tiny, lightweight little whatever you'd call them. They're almost like an insect. You can hear their wings moving. But when the wind blows in the direction in which they're flying, they can travel 50 miles an hour.
What?
Yep. And sometimes they fly nonstop when the winds are right.
Like when you're only a couple of inches long.
I know. Can you
50
imagine?
50 miles an hour is
if you hit something,
substantial.
That would be the end of that, wouldn't it? Like, oofta. Shoot.
Yeah.
So in order to maintain that kind of a, they have to eat a lot. And they do not like the cold, which is why they come and go. And so they actually can enter a hypothermic torpor state to survive.
Okay, what does that mean?
Well, that means that their like heart rate and metabolism would slow down and they would be, you know, it's like, I think it's like if a human fell into the icy cold water and, you know, everything kind of shut down.
Okay.
Or snakes, you know, and bears, they kind of like slow their metabolism down. And everything so that they can survive without eating or moving for quite a while. Now, where do they hide is what I want to know. I've never seen them in the trees, but I know they nest in the trees. But get a load of this. Their hearts. And when I say slow down their hearts, they seriously have to be in charge of that because their heart beats 1,260 beats a minute. And they take 250 breaths. A minute.
Wow.
So think about what we could do if we could like rev up our metabolism like that, huh? Maybe we could fly too. I don't know.
Right, yeah. We're a bit bigger than a couple inches. So what would be the math there on going 50 miles? Yeah, we're not going to do that. When they're going into that state, how much does that heart rate slow? Do you know?
I do not know. And I suppose it would probably depend on the temperature, actually. You know, because they stop about every 15 minutes and rest a little bit. And they really like certain trees, birch trees and butterfly bushes. And they also might rest on your hummingbird feeder if you don't have a cat that peers out the window at them constantly, we really try to protect them from that cat. So,
you know, when you feed other birds, a lot of times there is a seed mix and you put it out there. But hummingbirds, I feel like the only thing I have ever heard about hummingbirds is it's just sugar water. And then there's a little bit of an argument of sugar water with dye or sugar water in a container that is already colored. Do they eat anything besides sugar water and like what they're getting out of the plant?
And they get that same kind of nectar out of flowers.
Huh.
Also. And so do they, you know, usually like our hummingbird feeder is amber colored bottle. I suppose that protects the sugar water from the sun a little bit.
Mm.
And then there's tiny little bit of red on the tips of where they feed. You know, they have those tubular little mouths that go in there. And, of course, like I said, them stinking wasps are around there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
The hummingbirds do like red, though. Like, they must be able to determine the red color from other colors.
Mm-hmm.
Because
it's an easy one to see.
They have, right. And they have special cones in their eyes that the different shades of red show up. But I've seen them on other colored flowers. But they do. I do every year get a little red nail polish and paint the center of the little decorative area where they can eat from red because I really want them to come back. Now, this is the thing. The water, the nectar, does not have to be red. In fact, I would discourage you from coloring that water at all. And it's a very simple formula. If you take 1 cup of water and 1/4 cup of sugar, and you boil it till the sugar is completely dissolved, and then cool that off because you don't want to put it in there while it's hot.
Mm-hmm.
I actually make the nectar and keep it in the refrigerator so it's nice and cool. And then we just fill that feeder whenever, and they eat like, oh, I shouldn't say that. They eat like pigs.
They eat like hummingbirds.
The little birds, they eat like pigs. Oh, no. Oh, shoot. They eat some insects, too. Like, they must be really teeny tiny insects. But, yeah, don't tint that water. And definitely hang a feeder out because I seem to think this spring that there's less birds in our yard or less. There's less noise in the morning than there used to be, you know, when the birds wake up and they all start singing. I don't believe that the hummingbirds make any noise except for the hum of their wings. And they do like flowers, so definitely, you know, put a feeder out. But you can also expect them to visit your flower garden.
What are some of the best flowers for?
Red.
Okay, that was easy.
Anything. They have a heightened sensitivity to brightly hued red and yellow flowers. So I've seen them on my zinnias. And let's see, I've got moonflowers, which are white. You know, I've seen them down there. I've seen them down amongst the catmint in my herb garden and stuff. So I think they just kind of move around a little bit. But bee balm, which I plant every year, as much bee balm as I can possibly get away with without JC finding out, because that and foxglove are really good pollinator attractors. And bee balm grows so easy, you know, like.
Yeah, even I can grow bee balm.
Yeah, or borage. Borage grows really easy, and that's really a good pollinator flower, too. So, but there are others if you look them up online. And these little turkeys mate between March and July. So I would imagine they'd be extra hungry early in the year. So get those flower pots out on your deck, like geraniums. People put those out in May, and then you can bring them in if it's going to freeze. So
for someone like you who is a farmer's market producer, you want to be growing a number of vegetables and maybe some fruit. I'm just wondering, do you spread out those flowers specifically throughout the garden so that the hummingbirds are flying
everywhere?
Everywhere, including over the plants that you are trying to propagate for selling.
Yep. Every time I plant my garden, if there is one bare spot of dirt before I'm done, that gets borage or zinnias or sunflowers or something like that in there. And that not only gets them moving from one group of flowers to the next, it confuses some of the pests that come looking for, like, monocropping, which is planting one huge crop in one place. It's like serving dinner to pests. They're like, wow, check that out. And then they dive right in. Yeah. Whereas if you mix up flowers and herbs, basil and things like that, basil in my peppers, things like that to kind of help. It's companion planting and it's diversification at the same time. And it's kind of like when I walk into my high tunnel in the morning, I almost can't bring myself to leave because it's like the Garden of Eden. It's just a big tangled mass of whatever. You know, there's flowers here and sunflowers there and there's insects here. Although the grasshoppers are out right now, not my favorite. So I carry a clipper and cut those suckers in half.
Yeah, I was hiking on the Matahe Trail over Labor Day, and it was almost like you could pretend you were summoning the grasshoppers to go and do your bidding. Like you would just take a couple steps and there would just be swarms of them.
Let's digress for just 1 minute, okay?
You and me?
Oh, my gosh. This is so cool. Like I did these interviews with these German-Russian ladies, and one of the things that they always had in the fields during harvest was grasshoppers. Mm-hmm. And these kids would, like this one gal, oh, if I could think of her name. Anyway, it was so funny with her German accent. She goes, yeah, we'd pick those grasshoppers up and we'd go, spit tobacco. And I'm like, what? And she's like, if you take two grasshoppers and you hold them in your fingers with their wings locked and put them next to each other, they'll fight. Like, they're carnivorous. I actually saw three of them beating up on some granddaddy of a grasshopper, and then they were fighting amongst themselves. Mm. And they'll eat the heads off off of each other, and they'll spit this stuff out of their mouths. And it's really quite entertaining. Oh,
I would love to see you host a nature documentary, honestly.
We made this little video, and we put it on YouTube, and everybody's like, you've got to be kidding me. I'm like, it was so much fun.
I see Sue's getting into her own sugar water here.
Yes. Okay, breathe.
Slow the heart rate down. Be like the hummingbird.
So I suppose it's kind of mean that I do cut them in half, but they have sticky feet. You know, when you're hiking and they jump on you, they're kind of clingy.
Yeah.
I don't like that. So anyway, what I said earlier about hummingbirds not, you know, vocalizing in the morning like the other birds do, they do when they make a little chittering humming sound, you know, when they're mating. So they must move their wings in a little bit different way to make a mating call. So I'll bet there's some like amazing films about slowed down hummingbirds, right?
Yeah, Nature on PBS has a hummingbird program.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And they have some amazing footage.
And like
really
most
slowed down and macro lens.
Like yeah, and then they're in the sun and they're just beautiful colored. And of course, the males get to be better colored than the females. But however, in every good society, the female is the one who selects the nest site based on view, I'm sure. And she builds a nest and they're about the size of a thimble. And it takes a week for them to build. And they use a little moss and a little lichen, some plant down. They actually collect spider silk. Is that not cool? I suppose that,
cool.
gives it a little strength.
Yeah.
Cotton fibers, you know, whatever you can find out there blowing around in the wind.
I like to point out to my husband that a great number of bird species, the males wear colorful clothing and they know how to dance to try to attract their mate. And I'm like, I'm just saying. You could have more than 17 gray t-shirts.
Hey, yeah, I know what you're saying. And then there's the dancing thing, you know?
Yeah. Do hummingbirds do that? Do they have a mating dance?
You know what? I don't know, but I'm going to try to find that out. Oh, and then they hatch. We forgot. After they mate and they build a nest and all that good stuff, they have these really teeny tiny little eggs. They hatch in 14 days.
Hmm.
And the young fledge in about 3 weeks. And I don't think.
How big are they when they're born?
That's what I was going to say. I can't even imagine. They can't be much bigger than a grasshopper or a hornet, you know?
Yeah.
And guess what? The female also asks the male to leave after they mate so that she can take care of the eggs and feed the young. And the young get the insects. So I imagine it's like the same old thing where the birds chew up the insects. And
How long does the average hummingbird live?
Well, if they're not caught by my cat, 3 to 6 years. Okay. But they did find the oldest living hummingbird to be 9 years old. So that's pretty cool. But how would they know that, you know?
Yeah, well, the oldest one on record.
So they must have followed it around. It'd be impossible to tag them, don't you think?
I don't know how you would do that.
Put a little ring on their finger and it would keep them weighted down, huh?
Yeah, right.
And just like us, my dear, the female hummingbird has a longer lifespan than the male does by several years.
For what we have to put up with.
Yeah, you're hatching those stinking eggs for one.
Now, you mentioned if the cats don't get the hummingbirds, they can live 3-6 years. What other kinds of things go after hummingbirds?
One of my least favorite birds of late are blue jays. Blue jays will attack hummingbirds and other birds, and they're noisy little suckers. But the praying mantis will also attack a hummingbird if the opportunity is there. Yeah, can you imagine that? Praying mantis, they're about to be about the same size, right? And occasionally, if the hummingbird is sipping nectar from a pond lily, there might be an occasion where a fish would go, oh, look at the colorful lure.
Wow.
And that would be the end of that bird. So that would be sad, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I suppose their big defense mechanism is that they can get away so fast.
Right, right. But and they are tiny, they could hide quite easily, I'm thinking, too. But as you can tell, I'm totally in love with my hummingbirds, and I was so happy we were able to save that one.
Oh, good. Oh. Well, we check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thanks, Ashley.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. We rely on computers for everything from games to avoiding traffic to curing disease. We're creating a generation of machines that can learn, but what does this mean, and what more do we need from them than just conclusions? Join me and my guest, Emily Sullivan, as we explore the role of scientific exploration in artificial intelligence. That's What is Machine Learning and Why is it Important to Philosophy? On the Next Why Radio, Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 9th. On this date in 1998, St. Louis Cardinals slugger Mark McGwire shattered the longtime home run record set by North Dakota's Roger Maris. With his historic homer electrifying baseball fans, both McGwire and Maris were front-page news. Roger's 37-year-old record was a testament to the batting brilliance of North Dakota's adopted son. "It would not have ended this way in the movies," wrote Mike McFeely of The Forum.
there was not enough majesty, enough drama, enough anticipation for Hollywood. McFeely continued, "McGuire is king of the tape measure, master of the upper deck shot." That new king paid a sensitive tribute to the player he had bested. The Forum's Dave Kolpak reported that after the famous home run, McGuire paid a final and touching tribute to the Fargo hero, climbing into the stands at Busch Stadium and embracing the four sons and two daughters of Roger and Pat Maris. On the back page of that day's Fargo Forum, a stunning full-color Maris caricature appeared by the hand of newspaper cartoonist Trygve Olsen. Forum writer Dave Kolpak wrote that there was likely only one man among the players in Busch Stadium during McGuire's record-breaking Tuesday night who had actually visited the Roger Maris Museum at the West Acres Mall in Fargo. That was Chicago Cubs catcher Scott Servais. He had strolled through the museum while on a trip to Fargo to watch his brother play football for the NDSU Bison. Servais said, "It was very cool. I was happy to have had the chance to see the museum, especially with what's happened this season." McGuire, in a press conference, told reporters that he met with the Hall of Fame folks and they pulled out Roger Maris's bat and allowed him to touch it. "I touched it with my heart. Now I can honestly say my bat will lie next to his, and I'm damn proud of it." And what fate became the famous baseball that McGuire launched? McFeely wrote that the ball could potentially have become a million-dollar souvenir. It landed in a Busch Stadium location inaccessible to the public. A groundskeeper named Tim Ferranis retrieved the famous sphere and personally delivered it to Mark McGuire. What a fan. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Two brothers, identical twins, were working in the North Tower of the World Trade Center on the morning of 9/11.
Doesn't feel like 20 years to me. It's yesterday to me.
One made it out, one did not.
I often try to imagine what the hell those people went through. I guarantee my brother went out like a hero. He probably tried to help people out.
A September 11th survivor tells his story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, as humans, we like to think that our ability to process complex, abstract thought is what separates us from other animals and machines. But then we have something called machine learning. What is that, and why is it important to philosophy? We tackle that with philosopher Jack Russell Weinstein. That's tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.